Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Karen Elizabeth Gordon. She is the author of some of the oddest and most peculiar and strange books on the face of the earth, and the most recent one is called Torn Wings and Faux Pas, or Torn Wings and Faux Pas, but we wanted you to hear the paw in faux pas. It's published by Pantheon. Recently published as well is Paris Out of Hand, a bizarre guidebook to an imaginary Paris with more hotels than Joseph Cornell ever fit into a Cornell box, published by Chronicle Books. There is the one overtly fictional work called The Red Shoes and Other Tattered Tales. It was published by Donkey Archive Press. She is the author as well of The Disheveled Dictionary, The New Well-Tempered Sentence, and The Ravenous Muse, and The Deluxe Transitive Vampire. And that is the works. Now, these books, as I say, are very odd. They all purport to be something other than what they are. And what they seem to be, at least on the surface, is grammar books. Except that these books of rules contain examples from worlds in which it basically seems as if rules do not apply. And so they are orderings of the unorderable. They're chartings and gridlocks of the imagination. And spread throughout them are characters, vampires, dragons, succubi of various sorts, who appear as examples of grammatical problems, but who have an independent life of their own in this Karen Gordon world. Now tell me how this started.
I'm not sure. I'm sure it started when I was a child, but the grammatical aspect of the books has served as a pretext for me, and I discovered when I was doing The Well-Tempered Sentence, the first book that I did, that I felt like I was simply catching a story midstream. And the reason I was writing these books was that I was getting to experience all of these little worlds. I actually felt that I was peering in on them. And I've noticed that as these books go on, I sort of feel that they're all one book in a way, even though some of them don't fit into the grammatical series, the language series. The same characters will reappear. I've noticed as I go on that a few characters will drop out and some new ones appear with each new book. But more and more, I'm exploring these imaginary landscapes that I think are in part representations of emotions, various qualities of ourselves, qualities of literature. They have textures and a sense to them, and they're also largely inspired by Balkan landscapes, which have been important in my life, either in person or through literature.
Now, I want to start by talking about The Red Shoes, because I thought, in despair, that I would go to The Red Shoes and find the key to all of this, because this was ostensibly fiction. But The Red Shoes and Other Tattered Tales is, in fact, a dictionary book, and it's got words that are pertinent and footnotes, good for red shoes, that lead you, if you're not reading alphabetically, from one text to another, so that as you read, you are either putting together a story or even failing to put together a story. Because part of the experience, I think, is meant to be bewilderment at first.
It's partly my own take on what experience is like, that things are not linear. I always feel when I see a movie or read a novel that at a certain point it makes a choice to go in a particular direction, and to me there are many other directions it could possibly go in. So in The Red Shoes and Other Tattered Tales, there are maybe six main stories with a lot of other minor stories going on, and they keep overlapping and intercepting each other, and they're working along some of the same themes so that one story will refer to another. But it's this aspect that we never really do see the whole picture, and stories don't really come to an end.
The Red Shoes, as far as I can parse it, there is a mannequin. It is coming apart. It has been filled with papers.
Oh, that's right.
The papers are spilling out. In fact, some paper-wrapped salmon fillet is wrapped in one of the pages of the text. And there are two seamstresses who are putting together, stitching together, these bits and fragments that have fallen out of the original mannequin. Mm-hmm. Now, what are...
And that mannequin actually appeared. This is what happens with my work. The dummy was born in a single sentence in The Well-Tempered Sentence. She was in diamonds and furs in an opera box. And then the next thing I knew when I was writing The Red Shoes, she was sitting on a yacht. And
yes,
this millionaire that she picked up at the opera had taken her off, and she ripped her kneecap on a nail on the deck chair, and a Croatian seamstress who got away from Istria during the winter noticed she was going to start to stitch her knee back together, and she discovered that she was stuffed with shredded manuscripts and libretti, and so she's putting it together with this seamstress in Scandinavia that she's been corresponding with. And the two women actually correspond to my two grandmothers, whom I never knew. Both of them died long before I was born.
Now, what is it that they are putting together? What is the Urtext
here? They're stitching together the narrative handkerchief is one way that I put it in here. They're puzzling through the connections, I think, of partly... It's partly what it is to be a woman. I mean, a mm-hmm. lot of this is about a particularly feminine experience of the world. It's very sensory. And I think that that's one reason that clothing and stitchery is important, you know, as the kind of overriding metaphor of this book. And, for instance, there are a few standard fairy tales that I'm doing versions of without ever having looked at the originals. The Red Shoes, The Little Match Girl, and Hansel and Gretel and Cinderella, and where I'm exploring the metaphors of what those red shoes mean, and in each case there's a certain amount of torment or humiliation that's involved, but each of these characters has a kind of indomitable spirit that they really owe to having an imagination to find their way out of whatever particular torture they are undergoing, minor or major.
Now, lurking in the background, I sense a figure like Ronald Fairbank, because there's a world of, you know, beautifully decadent sentences and sexually ambiguous figures, not just ambiguous, but people who literally change their sexes
mm-hmm.
back and forth.
That's
as in
right.
Orlando. And there is a kind of vocabulary that is the kind of jaded vocabulary of Fairbank, dracunculi, and, you know, the strange wandering in an artificial garden, purporting to be real, yes?
Yes, yes, and I didn't even know who Fairbank was for years and years. When The Vampire came out in England, someone wrote a blurb with Ronald Fairbank's name, and it was Stephen Moore who actually finally really put me in touch with Fairbank and sent me a book of his, and I started reading him, and actually I found it much more interesting to read about him. He's such an intriguing character, but I do see that we share this love of simply sentence by sentence. I mean, a lot of my pleasure is writing, exploring everything that can go on in a single sentence.
Mm-hmm.
and these structures that I have, because I'm occasionally addressing these issues about grammar and usage and punctuation, that's kind of the perfect setting for me to see how far I can go, given this limitation. But then I wasn't satisfied with that, and I wanted to start to link things, and so the books have become more and more novelistic.
Now, the metaphor for me in the course of reading these books, I've read five of them now, is sort of the data bank, because I've
had... Oh, not
had,
data bank.
Well, the data bank, but I've had to store... Uh-huh. A good deal of information, even between volumes, in order to create the ongoing narrative textures of the lands, the people, their adventures and their travels.
And you're having to fill in yourself, right?
Yes.
That's what I want the reader to do.
Yes.
It's definitely an invitation.
Now, while the books are very definitely, I would say, feminist works, many of the godparents are men. Cortázar, Apollinaire.
That's right.
It's a very interesting thing. There are relatively few women writers providing strands, and I wondered if you would talk about that.
It's something that I have puzzled about myself, and when I put together The Ravenous Muse, I again had to encounter the fact that my favorite writers are, for the most part, male writers, and there aren't that many women writers who really ignite me in a particularly almost chemical way. When I read Cortázar for the first time, it was a chemical reaction I had to it, and I wrote him about it. I'm still not sure exactly what that's all about, because by the time I write my subject matter, even though the form and there's a little bit of a flavor of these male writers, I think maybe it has to do with the fact that I was always unhappy with the few choices that were available. There was poetry, there was short story, there was novel, and drama. And I didn't accept any of those categories. And then I started reading the French prose poets, most of whom were men, and Cortázar, and a few of the novelists of his vein. And with Cortázar, I'm thinking particularly of Cronopios and Famas. That was the first book of his that I read.
Especially.
And I was just ecstatic when I read that. I thought, oh, this is a mind that works in some way mine does. You really can write a book without forcing it into one of these other, you know, preconceived forms, and finding a new way to put things together.
Well, it has a thrilling advantage of having been translated by a poet, by Paul Blackburn.
Yes.
So the Cronopios and Famas, which is out of print, as many of the thrilling books are, but can be found, is as beautiful, I would say, in English as it is in Spanish. It's quite an achievement.
And Cortázar had a relationship with Paul Blackburn very similar to the one I had with his wife.
Mm.
I mean, he said it was just amazing. There were all of these different parallels in the way that we found each other and the way our friendships developed.
Now, it does seem to me, though, that one of the things that's true of the Dadaists and the Surrealists is true of your work as well, and may explain this question in part of sexuality and gender. It seems to me that whether I'm looking at a Dada work like The Gas Heart by Tristan Tzara, that one is looking at the consequences of sexuality. Something has happened to the body. Now we have a gas heart. Now we have an exquisite corpse.
Mm-hmm.
And in your work as well, the body has been transformed. Vampirism is one of those ways of transforming the body. So is the androgyny and
and the sex changing that goes on. And
even when,
and that's partly because I think language is very physical.
Mm-hmm.
I experience it as, and I want my readers to have an experience of language as an actual physical sensation.
Mm-hmm. I think it's time to let listeners hear, and I thought we'd do it in the proper surrealist way. You stick a knife into a book and you find, you know, what the knife is pointing to, as I did just before the show. And I'm going to ask Karen Elizabeth Gordon, my guest, to read a section from Torn Wings and Faux Pas, a handbook of style, a beastly guide through the writer's labyrinth. I found myself facing the use of the expression vis-a-vis, and we're going to read from vis-a-vis to which what?
And this I suppose I'll read the rules as well. It was funny that you brought up the knife and cake metaphor, because in The Red Shoes, Cinderella says, eat your cake and make it too, which is another way of that defying the limitations and living within the boundaries at the same time. Okay, vis-a-vis. This isn't really a francophone's or pompous ass's synonym for about or concerning in the course of a normal exchange. Where the expression does belong is in proposing or seeking comparisons, stating or asking how one thing is seen in relation to another. And now we come to a venue that is very present in many of my books, the Schloss. What's your take on the pandemonium at the Schloss vis-a-vis the commotion in Amplo Cha-Cha? Asked the nanny of the bandit, gagged and bound in the baby dragon's playroom, while the au pair tickled him with a feather from Duchess Ilona's recent molting. It's thanks to Ricky Ducournay's illustrations that Duchess Ilona has feathers in this book. And Amplo Cha-Cha is the capital city of Bleeg, which is one of my imaginary countries. The others include Tajikistan, Azuriko, Labukistan, Luvalandia, which contain wolves. For which what? As interrogative adjectives to ask questions about a choice or selection, these two are not interchangeable. Which implies choice from a limited number of things, while what is the word when the choice is unlimited? Which pair of fidgety shoes is missing from the cluttered closet of Duchess Ilona? What paper do you read for such an odd slant on the vicissitudes of Tajikistani politics? Which interloper do you suspect? Frodo Desange, Serafima Dos Equis, or Drasko Mustafovich, who is the absent owner of the Schloss.
Let's go on a little bit. Let's do a few more.
Okay.
Karen Elizabeth Gordon reading from some of her grammatical guides.
One of the things that I want to say about Torn Wings and Faux Pas is that I dealt with my ambivalence about being perceived as a language authority, whereas I'm really a fiction writer who's translating the rules into something that we can all understand by inventing six eccentric fictional authorities that I often cite throughout Torn Wings and Faux Pas, including a fellow named Startling Glower, who has a show called Up Your Eponym, and I occasionally refer to thrilling episodes. Okay, this is for imply and infer, and I pack them both into one sentence. And it's in the mouth of my character named Jonquil, who's a cartographer. But when you offered me a job in the map room, you implied that I'd soon be on my way to the lands delineated in its drawers. I inferred that a series of perilous adventures awaited me. Serpents with wings slithering out of rose bushes. Bandits in boleros telling my fortune with cards. Penguins in Patagonia taking my orders at roadside cafes. Slumber parties with lycanthropes smoking cigarettes. And refugees from rejected realms sketching out new territories to which we'd all escape. And I think some of these new territories are lands that I've invented for refugees from all of the places in the world that are being torn apart by internecine strife.
Well, there's a good deal of Serbian, and I sensed that there was a whole interest in those worlds in which boundaries have become mm-hmm. impossible to imagine.
Yes, and when I have been in Europe, the places that have fascinated me the most are these kinds of borderlands that over the centuries constantly changed mm-hmm. hands with the Austro-Hungarian and the Turkish empires, and you feel those layers of cultures there. They're all very present, and they affect the language, the dress, the customs, the identity of the people there. And I think some of the most interesting literature has come out of those places.
Well, it's fascinating, of course, that, you know, Serbian and Croatian were once Serbo-Croatian,
yes.
and these two languages are virtually the same language, but they've insisted on having mm-hmm. two different names
now
for the language.
Serbian and Croatian, yes.
And so one begins to have experiences like the one in The Wizard of Oz, where there's a translator between two people who are speaking the same language. This happens in mm-hmm. the Land of Oz. They keep needing to have their own words repeated so that the other who speaks the same language can understand them. These kind of conundra occur frequently in these books by my guest, Karen Elizabeth Gordon. She is my guest today on Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now tell me.
It just occurred to me that some of the strangeness comes from the fact that I feel that we're all really just barely learning to speak English in this country, even those of us who were born with it and are growing up with it, that I feel that that is an unknown country, that
the language itself is the unknown country.
Yes, and there's always more to know. And we never can count on having every word that we know available to us at a given time. That's one of the things that is exciting about writing. All of a sudden, a new vocabulary is available.
Well, it's also the case, it seems to me here, that your favorite books have not been written, in fact, in English, and that these examples are attempts to replicate in English some of the traumatic and amazing effects one finds in literatures that are not ours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is something that has struck me many times, too, that all of these books that I love, nearly all of them, are translated, and so I'm honoring the translator as much as I am the original writer, for instance, in The Ravenous Muse, where I have a collection of these things, and it's my homage to writers who've been important in my life. And I remember comparing two different translations of Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, and hypothesizing that one of the translators didn't even start out with English as her native language because she seemed to choose the Latinate version of every word, whereas the other translator, Michael Glennie, was, you know, using a lot more Anglo-Saxon.
Well, it's fascinating in particular with that book because there are three, I think, translations
new,
now into English. And each time one reads it, one becomes aware that the nature of fantasy in particular seems to be inflected by choice of word. There are 100 possible word choices in a Dreiser sentence that would all be as good as one another. But a fantasy really depends, it seems to me, on the kind of word chosen rather than its meaning.
Yes, yes, and that's what's important to me, too, that meaning is only one small part of what counts in a word or in a sentence, that sound and these kind of mysterious other qualities that words emanate, you know, like they all have their own force fields around them.
I wanted to talk to you about the danger subject of whimsy. Because if these books can be accused of anything, now I don't regard it necessarily as an accusation. My favorite book in the world is Alice in Wonderland. But there is a point where a reader can throw up his hands and say, or hers, mm-hmm. and say, it's all whimsy. Can you justify mm-hmm. whimsy?
yes, I think it's necessary. I think that whimsy should be encouraged in our education systems from the very beginning. I think it's something that has been far too suppressed, and it's an essential step in creativity of any sort. I mean, a great deal of science comes from whimsy, really.
As a wordsmith, I wanted to propose to you a series of words just for response and see where they go, just in their reference to your own practice. The first one would be endlessness.
I find as I am finishing a book that it's almost as if I'm falling through the bottom of it. And sometimes I have the feeling of falling as I'm writing because I'm suddenly discovering more layers and more levels to what this is, and I'm finding out more about these characters, you know, in a single sentence. Or in Paris Out of Hand, I had a much larger, more generous structure to work with because there were, you know, two-page pieces of guest entries in the hotels and so forth. But I never feel that I entirely leave something behind, and I never know when a particular character or a situation is going to reappear.
Which leads me to insatiability.
Yes, I think that I am voracious as a reader, and I want my own readers to also, in a way, be insatiable, because there's nothing as dull as sated hunger, I think.
Now, the final one I want to ask you about is maybe a complicated one. Theory.
Give me practice any time.
Well, I sense here that there's a fairly complicated relationship to theory, because the means of these texts is full of fragmentation. You're talking about many of the subjects that theoreticians talk about.
Yet I never read theory.
Yes, it seemed to me that it's aligned and yet despised.
Mm-hmm. Because I think that the reason that I avoid theory is that, for one thing, I hate generalizations, although I realize that that's a generalization in itself. It's a very particular one. But also, I absolutely abhor abstract language. You know, I need things concrete. I need to be naming things, and I need things to be visible and palpable. So any theory that I generate is in those terms.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Karen Elizabeth Gordon, whose most recent three books, and one doesn't dare to name only one because they all leap and bound into one another, but Torn Wings and Faux Pas comes from Pantheon, The Red Shoes comes from Dalkey Archive Press, Paris Out of Hand, A Wayward Guide comes from Chronicle Books, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.